This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One.
My name is Charles Woods III. I'm the Education Programs Manager, as well as the Community Outreach Coordinator here at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. So Martin Luther King Jr. was really thinking about giving up the idea of being a civil rights leader because he hadn't had a successful civil rights campaign since the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. And so Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, the civil rights leader here in Birmingham, also a co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, called Martin Luther King Jr. and told him that even though you had a good idea in Albany, Georgia, you just had the wrong venue. You should come to Birmingham, and then we can tackle Birmingham, the most segregated city in the country, and then you'll have more forward progress with this movement.
And what period of time was that?
Early 1963. And so King agrees, and he comes to Birmingham in 63. He's in 16th Street Baptist Church, full crowd, and he tells that full crowd that, yes, Birmingham is the most volatile, most racist, segregated city in the nation, but I think we can break Birmingham if we fill the jails. The adults understood several things. First thing they understood was Martin Luther King was not very successful in his last civil rights campaign. He was in Albany, Georgia over a whole year, was not able to get any successful civil rights concessions, and they knew that. And they knew that that can't happen in Birmingham. They also understood that living in Birmingham, that if you are seen protesting or being a part of this movement, you could lose your job, your home, you could lose your car, and ultimately maybe your life. And so the adults were not willing to volunteer to go to jail with King. But the young people started standing up, the children. And in the beginning, King was totally against it. He was, no, y'all children, y'all sit down, we're not going that route. And then he decided that he would go to jail with Ralph Abernathy and Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth. Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth and Abernathy are released. And this is ultimately where King wrote his famous letter from a Birmingham jail in response to 8 clergymen saying that what he was doing in the city of Birmingham was untimely. What they were trying to get King to understand is that Birmingham was already transitioning. It was transitioning from a commission-style government to a mayor-council government. And they thought that those changes would help facilitate some of these other changes with the segregation laws here in Birmingham. But King so eloquently told them why we can't wait. He didn't cuss anyone. He didn't call anyone out of their name. He, in an eloquently way, was able to tell them, we've been waiting for many, many years, and we can no longer wait. And so while King was locked up, they decided to organize the children. And they organized the children using code words and the radio. We had 2 hot disc jockeys here in Birmingham, Shelley the Playboy being one of the main ones. And they utilized the disc jockeys and their pull on the youth through the music. And they would use code words, and they would say things like, party in the park, don't forget your toothbrush. And what that meant was is that the idea was that you're going to jail and that you would spend the night in jail. And as a young person, you know you got to brush your teeth before you go to bed, right? And then you got to brush your teeth when you get up in the morning. So we're going to walk this way. And we're going to talk about a little bit specifically about Keller Ingham Park, but also the things that that took place here in 1963. So this park is a museum of itself. But it's a museum where I say that a half-truth is a whole lie. And that's what this park does. It has taken out some of the components of the story or the narrative that needs to be told here. So we are walking on Freedom Walk, and we're headed to our first gallery in the park. They have these water hoses, and as we get around the corner, you'll see them pointing at the young people. Because in 63, Bull Connor, who was the commissioner of public safety, he was over the fire department and the police department, decided that he was going to stop the Children's Crusade movement by pulling out Birmingham Fire Department and Birmingham PD. Now, what this gallery does not show is, it does not show the individuals holding the water hoses. Because
and
when
these are actual cannons?
Right, well,
these are the same.
But see, in the events that took place in the park during 63, they were just manned water hoses.
From the fire hydrant.
From the hydrant or from the truck. Whereas this is portraying that there was no human element involved in spraying these children with these hoses. So that's why I say this park tells half of the story. So and when you pay half the story, you're telling a whole lot.
These cannons actually fire. Right.
There's yeah.
The hose hooked up.
If these things really exist, because it was something that was fabricated, because they didn't want the population, the city population of the city of Birmingham, to start losing respect and admiration for your city workers, police department, fire department specifically. And so they did not portray the individuals that were holding these hoses on purpose. It's a good park, it's a good museum, but it doesn't tell the whole story. And my colleague has told me a half truth is a whole lie.
Well, that's the whole point there. It was a very human thing. It was human beings, not a machine.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And as we continue in the park, you'll see the other display over there. It's the same thing, but now they're portraying the dog. So the dogs are attacking. You see leashes, but there's nobody holding the leash. That doesn't tell the whole story. So if you're coming here and you're from another country, you would think that, oh, it was these machines or something that had something to do with this and not the individuals in control of those machines.
Well, that's exactly, when I looked at it, I didn't remember hearing or seeing anything about these things.
Right, because it did not exist.
Well, who came up with this? How was this decided?
That's a very good question. So Mayor Arrington, he was the one that was able to get the foundations for the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute established. I'm not exactly sure when the gallery here in the park was founded, but for some reason, whoever these city leaders are, they felt that they had to display this story a little differently, okay, so that people wouldn't lose that, you know, that foundational understanding and respect for your city leaders. Now, this is our Anne Frank tree. A lot of people recently, even more so, have been saying that this is the only thing in this park that has nothing to do with the civil rights movement. But that's totally erroneous. This tree was brought here to Keller Ingram Park by the Jewish community in the city of Birmingham. Even some of them don't understand is that when Hitler came up with what was called the Nuremberg Laws, he got the inspiration for those laws from the Jim Crow laws and the civil rights, and the black codes that were established here in America, in the South. So one of his main laws with the Nuremberg Laws was that an Aryan and a Jewish person cannot marry. That's a direct reflection of the laws on the books, still on the books here in Birmingham, in Alabama's Constitution now, where it says a black person and a white person cannot marry, okay? They cannot go to school together. All aspects have to be segregated. All of those ideas for the Nuremberg Laws that Hitler devised in the 30s came directly out of the page books here in America, including sterilization, eugenics, and some of the other atrocities the Nazi regime portray on Jews as well. So people say that this is the one thing that doesn't have anything to do with this part. When I say it has everything to do with it, and honestly, it should be a uniter and a linker between the two histories. So 63 being the hotbed year that it was, you had several different events that came down, and that also passed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 65 and the Civil Rights Act of 64. A lot of those things that changed the tide in those acts being brought to law happened right here in Birmingham. And a lot of these things happened right here in this park. So we're going to go over here to our other display. It's called the Kneeling Ministers. And this was something that happened in early 1963 as well. You had several ministers who were planning a march.
How many people, Max, might have been in this park at one time during the protests?
Ultimately, about 7,000 foot soldiers.
Here at one time.
Well, so they was...
Total.
Understand, first of all, that it was several days, okay? So the whole campaign lasted about 8 days. And so you have about 7,000 total foot soldiers. Those are all individuals that were ultimately arrested. But at one time, I would say no more than 200 individuals at one time. And that's because in the organizing aspect of the Children's Crusade, Fred Shuttlesworth had individuals coming out of 16th Street Church, 16th Street Baptist Church, two by two, but 50 at a time. And that's how they logged it, 50 at a time. 50, those 50 would get arrested. They'll come back out with 50 more. Those 50 would get arrested. But as the jails started to get full, the aspects of the campaign changed. So then you had three different routes. You had individuals that were coming to the park. You had individuals that were going out the back of 16th Street and going up 5th Avenue to the courthouse to protest. Then you had individuals coming out the front of the church, going up to 4th Avenue Business District, and then going on to like the Posits and to the Woolworths and doing sit-ins at the same time. So because you had three different routes, it's really hard to quantify the exact number of people that were here in the park,
sure,
because you had several different things going on. But then 50 at a time, and hoping that that 50 got arrested, I would say that you couldn't have more than 200 people here. Now, mind you, those are the people that were participating in the campaign. You had just neighborhood folks that were just around, too. And there was a lot of them, and they were crowding up, and they got a little belligerent. You know, they were throwing bottles at the police officers and rocks. And so I also had to make sure that I keep those two groups separate, because this is a nonviolent campaign. And so the individuals that were frustrated with the police and seeing what the fire department were doing with these hoses and decided to throw bottles at them and rocks or whatever were not the individuals participating in the movement. Reverend Porter, he was the pastor of Sixth Avenue Baptist Church and was also a leader in the movement, also a part of the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. They wanted to march in protest, but they did not have a parade permit, okay, which is usually the way that a lot of activists were arrested. You don't get your proper permits, you can't hold your march, and so they would be arrested. So these individuals did not have the proper permits, but they came up to, I want to say, 6th Street Baptist Church in this area. No, it was along this road right here on 6th Avenue. They stopped, they kneeled, they prayed, and then they turned around and they went back, okay? And then the inspiration for these faces, if you look at it good, it's the same face on each, on each preacher. And the person that they used as the model for that was none other than Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth. So each one of these statues has his face. But there were three different distinct individuals. We hold our Juneteenth celebration here in Keller Ingham Park. So it's still very much so a permanent fixture of the community. And it's still being utilized for different events and stuff as well.
More summer and fall events.
Yeah, yeah. And you'll see even, Birmingham sometimes doesn't have very hard winter. Sometimes we can, though. We have a couple of snowmageddons and stuff, but because of the weather in Birmingham really doesn't get that bad, you'll have some stuff here in the fall as well. So this is the other display that I was discussing previously. The fact that Bull Connor manifested and had configured in his mind that he was going to use Birmingham PD with the police dogs, and just this display shows dogs ready to bite. These dogs were sicked on young people. The youngest person arrested in this campaign was 4 years old. But this does not tell the whole story.
Four.
4 years old. And that was, so if you, I'm an only child, so I don't have this demographic, but if you have siblings and you were put in charge of keeping up with that sibling, then that sibling had to go where you went. So an individual who chose to participate in the campaign that was arrested, but was also tending to his younger brother, little brother got to go to jail too. But that's where the age comes from. And then you had everyone in between. Even Dick Gregory, who was a comedian at the time, probably one of the biggest superstars of that era, came down and participated in the Children's Crusade and was arrested as well and spent some time in jail with these young people. And so when you see this narrative, they're not showing the human aspect of individuals allowing these dogs to bite children. And that's why I say that in this part, they don't tell the whole story. And when you're not telling the whole story, you leave room for lies and other things like what we're going to talk about in just a little bit. So one of the myths that I like to bust when it comes to this narrative is that it was said that the water hoses had no pressure behind them. Okay? The water hoses had no pressure behind them. And just recently in my work with the Institute, I was able to visit a site along the Civil Rights Trail who had footage, exact footage of what went on in that park today. And they showed a water hose that was literally ripping a tree apart. I mean, it was mangling the tree. And then you had two little people behind it trying to, not get buzzed by that water. But it was literally ripping the tree apart. Another case in point is that the young lady who answered the phone call at 6th Street Baptist Church before that bomb went off, her name is Miss Carolyn McKinstry. She answered the phone call at 16th Street. They said, "You have 5 minutes." And she's like, "I don't know what that means, And by the time she hung up, the blast went off. But she was also a participant here in the Children's Crusade during 63. And she got sprayed in the head with one of those water hoses. And it literally ripped the hair out of her head, okay? So that's just a myth that I like to bust, because people are trying to portray an image that the things that happened with the civil rights movement really either wasn't that bad, or these people weren't directly involved, or whatever the case is. I'm having now to have to make sure that people understand the true narrative that says that those water hoses were literally pushing children down the sidewalk.
Well, I think you've seen the same footage where people were actually flying through the air.
Yeah. Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, once again, being the leader of that campaign, he was caught on the steps of 16th Street Baptist Church. Bull Connor saw him. He told one of his firemen, he said, "Hit that nigger with that hose." And they literally, Fred is not a big dude, but that water hose literally lifted him up off his feet and slammed him down on those stairs. And he cracked or broke several ribs. So he checked himself into the hospital. And so for the rest of the campaign, Fred is not there. But once the results of the campaign came down, and through the efforts of these young people, they were able to sit down with the business leaders of downtown Birmingham to desegregate downtown Birmingham. Fred had to literally check himself out of the hospital to be there for that meeting. Because you have Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy, two people who are going to leave Birmingham and go back to Montgomery, to where their congregations are located. So Fred knew that he had to be there for that negotiation. So he checked himself out of the hospital to make sure that he was there for those negotiations. So we're almost out of the park. Two more things. First of all, we have this scene right here. First thing I'd like to point out about this scene is that that young man that this portrays in this statue was not a member of the movement. He was passing through and got caught up. And he's like the famous image from this whole crusade is now his image. But he was not a participant at all, was trying to make his way somewhere else, made the wrong turn, and got caught up in this mess. But this is also one of the things that I like to talk about, because when it came to the Birmingham news, you have this massive civil rights campaign going on. But on the front page of the Birmingham News the next day, so you talk about a police dog who got his tail caught in the door and broke his tail or whatever. And instead of talking about what's happening to these young people fighting for their equality, fighting for the right to be able to function as a full citizen of this nation like anybody else, you want to talk about dog getting his tail caught in the door. Okay? And so I say that to paint the picture of the town that Birmingham was at that time and how they literally tried to wash over this movement.
Whitewash, good word, huh?
Very good word. Very fitting for some of the things that happened here. And so, like I said before, ultimately in the 8 days of the Children's Crusade, you had over 7,000 children arrested. And not only did they fill the Birmingham City Jail, they also filled the Bessemer City Jail, as well as the Jefferson County Jail. Now, there's one point that, and we'll talk about it a little more on the Institute, that I'd like to point out, is that if you were a black student in the city of Birmingham at this time, you rode the city bus to school, or you got dropped off, or you walked, or whatever. You did not have the opportunity to ride in yellow school buses. But because this movement was so massive, they had to call out the Jefferson County Department of Education to bring 6 school buses down to take these children to jail. So you'll see images of these children waving and smiling and happy and having a good old time on these buses, because that was their very first time ever being on a yellow school bus. But they're going to jail. But they're still happy about it, because, "Look, Mom, I'm on the yellow school bus. We don't get to ride school buses." And so those efforts of these young people allowed the business leaders of downtown Birmingham to sit down with Abernathy, King, and Shuttlesworth to talk about desegregating downtown Birmingham. And they did. This is also when Fred Shuttlesworth, as a leader of this movement, and Martin Luther King did not see eye to eye. So when Fred is checking himself out of that hospital, he's going down to that negotiating table to negotiate for black city councilmen, black firemen, black police officers, right? He wants very lofty goals. He has an agenda. Whereas King and Abernathy were negotiating for, "Let's take down the colored and the white signs, you know, on the drinking fountains. Let's hire a few folks in the background to work at the department stores downtown." Like, not really going for the gusto. Mm-hmm. And so when King ultimately won the Nobel Peace Prize, he was able to invite, I think, like up to 50 people. Okay? And Shuttlesworth did not get an invite. So just a little background story behind even how you all are fighting for the same goal, right? Everybody wants the same thing. So sometimes you have different ways of how you can get there. And right. Throughout the civil rights movement, you had different leaders who bumped heads on the tactics, you know what I'm saying? Not necessarily what was going on, but the tactics that were utilized, mm-hmm. okay? Case in point, right here on the backside of the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, you have the A.G. Gaston Motel. A.G. Gaston was a multimillionaire during the civil rights era. He made good money. And so he did not get involved in the movement because he didn't like the tactics. But he was a anonymous giver and donator. He said that he bailed Fred Shuttlesworth out of jail many a times, right? He also was able to bail out a lot of the children from the Children's Crusade, and he was able to put money behind parts of this movement. But he did not like the marching and the singing and some of those aspects. He thought of an economic way was probably a better way to tackle getting your equality. So we'll head over to the Institute. So as we walk through the park, though, I want you to pay attention to Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth's statue. It's out here in front of the Civil Rights Institute. And I always tell people, like, that's Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth. That is not Martin Luther King Jr. His statue is in the park. But this statue is out here in front of this building because if it was not for Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, this place would not be here. When he passed away in 2011, they held his body in the rotunda to pay homage to the civil rights leader here in Birmingham. One of his many quotes was, "God gave me a hard head because he knew I lived in a hard town." And we'll talk about how Fred Shuttlesworth was able to solidify himself as a civil rights leader in this town and what kind of individual leader you had to be a successful civil rights activist here in this town. And one thing, Fred did not consider himself an activist. He considered himself an actionist, okay? And he took it to segregation. One of his other many quotes was, "Either I'm going to kill segregation or be killed by it." It had a black architect by the name of Max Bond, if I'm not mistaken. And so the Dome has become a pretty known figure in the city now. We have people that come down all the time, different organizations that line up on our steps and take pictures. But all of this is by design. So as we're going up the stairs, I want you to pay attention to the shrubbery on each side of the staircases. The idea of the Institute came from Mayor David Vann, the last white mayor, right before our first black mayor, Richard Arrington, took over. And David Vann was in Germany. And he was in Germany for a conference or something like that and went to a museum there that they had about the Holocaust. And he thought to himself, he said, "Wow, this is great. Birmingham has a story. We need to create something to be able to tell Birmingham's story." So then when Richard Arrington became mayor in 1979, the year I was born, he tags of Miss Odessa Woolfolk, who was a local educator. She has no children of her own, had never been married, but she was a professor at UAB. She was a local high school teacher, went on to be a professor at UAB. And so she was commissioned with bringing the Institute to flourishing. And she has done that. Just went to a talk that she had just yesterday. She's still out there. I think she's about 85. She's still running. She's still doing. She's still very involved in the things that the Institute are involved in. And so what we also will talk about is separate truly equal, okay? So you see these two drinking fountains. You see the colored drinking fountain is really just a sink. The pipes are exposed. It means you never could get a cool drink. Whereas the white drinking fountain is an actual drinking fountain. The pipes are enclosed. You can get a cool drink. The colored drinking fountain is really just a sink. They're not really equal, right? But what makes this totally asinine is that both of these drinking fountains were fueled from the same water source. Right? So if that truly separate but equal, Birmingham specifically, but the South as a whole, was literally trying to create a caste system. A caste system just like the Hindu system that we know of, where it put blacks at the bottom, considered the untouchables. Now, that idea takes shape when you think about how the bus system worked here in Birmingham. If you were an African American, you wanted to ride the bus, you literally had to get onto the front of the bus, pay your fare, exit off of the front of the bus, and then enter in through the rear entrance. And so I always question, I'm from California, I always question, like, what? I don't understand why that was so important. And so because of this caste system where they were creating, where blacks were literally the untouchables at the bottom, they wanted to make sure that whites and blacks were never in such close proximity of each other that they may actually touch each other. So if you're an individual on that bus and you pay your fare normally and you walk down the center aisle of that bus, and if you've ever been in public transportation, you know that that bus can stop, jerk or something happened that you lose your balance. And as a black man, if I accidentally sat on a white woman because of the bus, that could literally mean my life. And so they wanted to keep people so separate that you wouldn't be in such close proximity. Case in point, this list of Birmingham racial segregation ordinances, okay? I'm going to read number section 369, separation of the races. It shall be unlawful to conduct a restaurant or other place for the serving of food in the city at which white and colored people are served in the same room, unless such white and colored persons are effectually separated by a solid partition extending from the floor upward to a distance of 7 feet or higher, and unless a separate entrance from the street is provided for each compartment. Okay, this is for business owners if you wanted to serve both races. If you wanted to serve both races, you literally had to have a wall in the middle of your establishment, also with a total separate entrance for each race. Most people are not going to do that, right? That costs money. You got to get contractors involved. You got to get permits to build and all of that. So what ultimately came down was that if you were a white establishment and you wanted to serve black patrons, you had to have some way that they can either order their meal or whatever it is, and then be able to take that somewhere else because they can't eat in the establishment to partake of it. So what most businesses did was they created a window to the outside where young lady like Sally here, who's looking in on these two students from Phillips Academy, having a malt or a beverage, where that person can come, make their order, get their malt, their beverage, or whatever it is, and then take that home to consume it. This is also the precursor to what ultimately became drive-through restaurants, okay? Just an outside window where you can serve folks while the inside may be closed or whatever the case. This is the precursor for that. In the film that you all watched earlier, just like Birmingham, England, is one of the few places in the world where all three ingredients to make steel is readily available locally. And so because of that, Birmingham created a booming steel industry. Sorry, it literally grew overnight to a population of about 300,000 individuals. So Birmingham was founded in 1871, and it was founded on the premise of the steel mills and the steel industry. So unlike Birmingham, England, or even Pittsburgh, Birmingham was not located by a major waterway. And so Birmingham became known as the River of Railroad. And it's literally railroads throughout this town, so much so that in specific neighborhoods, mostly black neighborhoods, you can get boxed in for the railroads, okay? But because Birmingham had that booming steel industry, it also had the lowest wages in the nation for labor wages for the steel industry. And so me being a historian, I'm like, why is that? Well, that's because of a system that was instituted called convict leasing system. And the way the convict leasing system worked was, if you were African-American male caught in the middle of the day, like maybe about now, without $7 to $8 in your pocket to signify that you had a job, you were considered a vagrant. And they would arrest you for vagrancy. Loitering also became one of those laws that was utilized against African-Americans to massively incarcerate them. And so what would happen is you would go to trial for what you thinking is just vagrancy. Somebody call my wife, let them know I have a job, somebody come get me. But a lot of times a stronger charge will be tacked on to that lesser charge. So now you're being convicted of vagrancy and rape. Rape holds a serious sentence. And so now you've been sentenced to whatever how many years, hard labor. And so what these steel mills would do is the wardens and the leaders of those steel mills would go to those local prisons and negotiate a fee for a person. Then they would take that person back to their mill or their steel mills. Pratt City was notorious for this, which is right here in Birmingham. And they would literally work those individuals to death. A lot of times throw them in a mass grave, go back to the prison, negotiate a fee again, get you however many more you need. And because of that convict leasing system and the industry that they utilize it in, it was hard to get a good paying job in the steel industry here in Birmingham because you had these folks literally working for nothing. And I always mentioned that convict leasing was worse than slavery, and I agree. Slavery was it is the most horrendous, dehumanizing act in the history of mankind. It'll go down as that. But when it came to convict leasing system in regards to slavery, slaves cost money. Slaves cost anywhere from $200 to $3,000 per person, depending on if you knew a trade, if you could play an instrument, read or write, which is a lot of times forbidden, but the ones that could read and write went for more money. But if something happened to that slave, you want that slave well. They break their leg, you want that leg mended, right? You want medical attention. Woman having a hard birth, you want the doctor there because you want to make sure that she can continue to have children and that that baby that she's having will be able to grow up and contribute to whatever you're trying to achieve, right? If you own cotton, tobacco, sugar, whatever. And so when it came to the convict leasing system, something as minor as you breaking your leg could be a death sentence. Throw you in a mass grave, go back to that warden at that prison, negotiate another fee, and just keep the cycle going. So it totally took the human aspect of it totally out. All right, you a baseball fan? Rickwood Field is here in Birmingham. Rickwood Field is the oldest ballpark in the nation. It was built in 1910, and it was patterned after the Forbes Stadium in, I think it's Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, one of the two. But Birmingham had two teams. You had the Birmingham Black Barons, and you had the Birmingham Barons. Original name was Birmingham Coal Barons, okay? Coal Town Steel, I promise you, and everything. And so, and then you also had the Birmingham Black Barons. The Birmingham Barons, during this era, not really a good team. The Birmingham Black Barons, though, they won three pennants in the Negro Leagues during the 40s. And so the Birmingham Black Barons was a popular team, doing very well. White folks wanted to come see them play. Now, Birmingham Black Barons and the Birmingham Barons have been trading weekends for who knows how long. Blacks play on one, whites play on the other one. Only black audience can go watch the black teams play. Only white audiences can go watch the white teams play. But not when the Birmingham Black Barons get a young kid by the name of Willie Mays. And they have a good squad and they win those three pennants in the 40s. Whites were sneaking off to go see the Birmingham Black Barons play. So much so that the city leaders had to change the city ordinances. So now the city ordinances at first included things as blacks and whites cannot play games together. And then they list what games they're talking about. No cards, no chess, no checkers, no board-type games. And then this is happening in the city with these whites sneaking off to go see the Birmingham Black Barons play. So then they updated and amended their racial segregation ordinances to include that whites and blacks cannot be in close proximity to play any game that has to do with a ball. And that's what it says, is right over there. And then they list not pool, not billiards, not basketball, baseball, football. And it says any other games with the ball. All because you had a successful black team in this city at the time. Now, once you go to work, you might go to a game, have some fun. But at some point, you're going to have to set foot in that classroom. And so during this time in the city of Birmingham, or the state of Alabama as a whole, the state of Alabama was spending $60 per African-American student and $120 per white student. Doesn't seem very equal, right, even though that they're separate. And if you look at these two different classrooms circa 1953, you see that the white classroom has books. They have a little multimedia. The black classroom, none. Each classroom has the pictures of the heroes on the walls. But if you pay attention to the desk, the black classroom has double the class load. So as a teacher who was teaching black students, you had to be very clever in how you brought your lessons across. Because not only are you starting off from the jump with half the funding, double the course load, but you also have outdated materials. So y'all remember those lines in the book, right? You fill up that last line, it's time for that book to do what? It's outdated. We don't need it no more. But once these books were outdated on this side, these books went to those classrooms. So in a black classroom as a teacher, automatically starting off with half the funding, double the course load, outdated materials. And at this time, blacks were only educated to the 10th grade. That was a means to keep blacks from being able to enroll in colleges and universities. So to be a teacher on this side, you had to have a very unique way that you brought that lessons and those things across. here in the city of Birmingham, we had what was ultimately the largest African-American high school in the world at one point. School was so big that they had two shifts of where people went to school. Now it's known as A.H. Parker High School. But back then, it was known as Industrial High. Then it was known as Negro High School, because in the city of Birmingham, you literally had two boards of education. You had a black board of education, you had a white board of education. And that black board of education was able to ultimately petition to be able to be educated to the 12th grade. And so Industrial High School became that center for black education in the city of Birmingham. And so once they were able to go on to the 12th grade, then you had massive enrollments in schools like Miles College, which is a HBCU, Historic Black College University, located in Fairfield, not too far from the Birmingham City Center. All right? So once you go to school all week, right, on the weekend, you want to go have some fun, right? So I'm going to get directed to our replica Carver Theater. Carver Theater was a theater that was part of the Chitlin Circuit. Chitlin Circuit was a series of clubs where black audiences could see the top black acts of the time without having to sit in the balcony or do any of that other stuff, okay? In the city of Birmingham, you had three major theaters, all right? You had Carver Theater that was all black. You had the Alabama Theater that was all white. Then you had the Lyric Theater, which was a mix where whites would sit on the floor, blacks would be in the balcony. And this was an opportunity for blacks and whites in the area to see the top acts of the town. People like Louis Armstrong, Betsy Smith, Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington, all of those individuals played on the Chitlin Circuit. Also, Alabama hometown boy by the name of Nat King Cole. Nat King Cole, from Alabama, he's not from Birmingham, but he came to do a concert here in the city of Birmingham in 1956. It was at the Boutwell Auditorium. The Boutwell Auditorium was a municipal auditorium, and he would do two shows. He would do a show early for whites, then he would do a show later on that afternoon for blacks, so that everyone got the opportunity to see him perform. Well, while he was on stage in 56 at the Municipal Auditorium, two individuals from the National States Rights Party decide that, which is kind of an offshoot of the KKK, decide that Nat King Cole's music is contributing to the delinquency of young white youth. So they literally tack him on stage in the middle of his performance, roughed him up pretty bad. And then they were surprised to understand why they were being arrested. And so what these individuals didn't understand is that you had a sold-out crowd of white folks who wanted to see Nat King Cole perform. And so they made sure that they were arrested. And Nat King Cole on that day vowed that he will never come back to the state of Alabama to do a show. And he's from Alabama, and he lived up to that. But what he did do was he did stay later on that night and still perform for the African-American concert. So very important that you get an opportunity to wind down, right, have a little fun. But that Sunday night, you got to get up early in the morning for what? Church in the morning. So we're going to direct you to our church gallery. And our church gallery is located in the center of the Barriers Gallery because at this time, the church was literally the center of the African-American community. Now, we're going to bust a myth. One of the myths that we're going to bust really quickly is that all African-Americans were involved in the civil rights movement. That is not the case, all right? New information has come down to say about as little as 4% of the African-American population was actually involved in the civil rights movement.
Actively,
exactly. And so one of the many nicknames that Birmingham has, it is also known as the Land of Churches. And during this movement, you had about 800 churches in the city of Birmingham. But in regards to the civil rights movement and all of those churches, only these 60 churches were involved in the civil rights movement. And that's because Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, with other local ministers and preachers, had to create the organization called the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. And that organization was created because of the success of the Montgomery bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. What happened was the state asked the NAACP to reveal the list of all of their roster, all of their members. We want a list of everyone that's a member of this organization. And the NAACP refused. Rightfully so, because if they would have given up that list, I guarantee you some death would have happened. Individuals would have been killed, houses bombed, something of that sort. And so the NAACP refused. And in that refusal, there was a state injunction filed to say that the NAACP cannot function in the state of Alabama. They can't do anything.
Who filed that?
I have his name, and it's on the tip of my tongue, but it has
one dude.
Yeah, it was one person, and that person, he was part of the White Citizens Council. It was a covert effort to try and get the NAACP out of the state. And so Fred Shuttlesworth, seeing that happening, being a member of the NAACP himself, decided that he did not want to lose any ground in the civil rights movement. So him and other local preachers in the area created what's known as the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. So let me also, in that name, bust another myth. The other myth is that the Communist Party is responsible for the civil rights movement. I've just recently started hearing that. I never heard that growing up. Just started recently hearing that, but I want to dispel that myth as well. And in the dispelling that myth is in the name that Fred Shuttlesworth came up for his organization. Alabama, they chose the name Alabama because they figured that it would be bigger than just Birmingham. And that other individuals in other parts of the state will be able to utilize this organization to continue the civil rights movement to fight for their equal rights. So that's why they chose the name Alabama. They chose the name Christian to purposefully separate themselves from the Communist Party. Because you know the Communist Party has no religion involved in their ideology. And so to make sure that they were not associated with anyone saying that the civil rights movement was involved with communism, he made sure that he had the name in there, Christian, to show that this was a religious movement. So right there is just looked like they were exiting one of the mass meetings. Shuttlesworth did not want to lose any ground in the movement, so he had this organization created so that they can pick up where the NAACP left off in the state, Birmingham specifically, and continue to fight for the gains necessary to have your equal rights. So 16th Street right there is a part of the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. And First Congregational Church was the only integrated church in the city of Birmingham as a whole. And it's located on Center Street, which is also known as Dynamite Hill. And we'll talk a little bit more about Dynamite Hill. The Colored Masonic Temple was one of the only areas in the city where Birmingham businesses could have office space. So if you look at this directory, you literally see a little bit of everything. They also had a club in the basement, an area where people could perform at the top, not on the roof, but it was like in the penthouse area. But like I said before, you got Boy Scouts of America. You have a lot of attorneys that were able to have office space in here. You got billiards in the basement, tax insurance companies, as well as dentists and doctors. Well, one of my colleagues that works here, his doctor's office was located in the Colored Masonic Temple. And his mother worked at what's now known as Highlands, UAB Highlands Hospital. It was called Highlands back in the day, which was a hospital. It was mostly white, but they could serve blacks in the basement.
Separate,
right. And in that basement where they served blacks separately, it was like a hodgepodge of whatever could be going on. So you could literally be right next to a woman having a baby, somebody having surgery, and somebody else got a broken leg, but same space together. And so he always questioned his mother, who was a nurse at the Highlands, why do I have to go to that dusty old office in the Colored Masonic Temple for my doctor's appointment? Why I can't go to the Highlands where you work? And she had to explain to him that you're not allowed at the Highlands, but also this is where generational things can happen, where you continue either a racist ideology or an ideology of lack, but it continues through generationally because her doctor's office was located in the Colored Masonic Temple. So why would I give you anything that wasn't as good for me? And so we'll keep going. And as you think about how things were separate but unequal, within the black community, you had to create a cohesive community where you served yourselves or you served your own, because there were plenty of services and things that you could not get if a white person or organization or company was not willing to give it to you, then you just had to go without. Case in point, ambulances. There were no black ambulances. The ambulance in the black community was the hearse at the local funeral home that served black individuals. So if you needed someone to be rushed to the hospital, you had to call down to the funeral home, whether it was Smith Gaston, whether it was Poole Funeral Home, it's right around the corner, to get someone to bring that hearse down so you can utilize that to get to the hospital, okay? So if you didn't have the services within your own community, you had to create them, all right? And that's exactly what A.G. Gaston did. He was a multimillionaire at this time, and he was able to do that by fulfilling a very simple philosophy. See a need, fill it. See a need, fill it. And we're going to talk about that once we get in our barbershop. But I have to point this one thing out right here. It's an exhibition at the Birmingham Museum of Art right now about redlining and the idea of redlining, how they were legally instituting segregation in big cities all across the nation. The blacks who lived in certain areas, they made those areas undesirable or hazardous, which meant that you don't want to go there as a real estate agent or someone or like a developer or things of that sort. That would keep those services and those type of individuals out of those areas because it was deemed either hazardous, Negro concentration, or undesirable. So in the city of Birmingham at this time, the African-American population was 43% of the population. 43% of the population, but they were relegated to live in 11% of the living spaces. So what doesn't make sense is that even if you were an African-American, somebody who was well off, not maybe not like A.G. Gasson when you're a multimillionaire, but somebody that owns their own home or owns, you know, has a good job, owns their vehicle or whatever, and you might want a nice brick house with a basement. But because you were relegated to live in 11% of the living spaces, then a lot of times this was the type of home that you could see yourself living in. You know what this is called? It's a Southern thing for real. You know? Huh?
Shotgun house.
They call them shotgun houses because you could literally shoot a shotgun through the front door and go straight out the back door and not touch anybody and not harm anything. But shotgun houses were very cheaply made. They were very easy to be made. And a lot of times the coal mines and the steel mills and stuff would build these houses for their workers. But as a black person who may not want to live in a shotgun house, you were relegated to live in a shotgun house because you just can go live wherever you wanted to go live, okay? The first person to test those laws is a woman by the name of Mary Means Monk. Mary Means Monk lived on Center Street. Center Street was literally the color line of Birmingham. On the right-hand side of Center Street was black. On the left-hand side was white. What blacks were able to do was they decided to move literally across the street and start having houses built. That's what Mary Means Monk did. She would get the skeleton frame up of her house. The KKK would come by and burn it down. She went and did that again. That happened several times. Ultimately, she was able to bring her house to fruition, only for the KKK to ride by, light a stick of dynamite, and throw it. It hit the roof, rolled down the side of the roof into the gutter where it ignited, blowing her house up. Okay, which she ended up rebuilding again. You also had Arthur Shores was a civil rights attorney, but he's also a benefactor of some of these so-called separate but equal laws that were going on in Birmingham. I mean, going on in Alabama as a whole. So Arthur Shores wanted to be a lawyer. He went to Talladega College, got his undergrad degree, applied to go to a law school here in the state of Alabama. They refused him admittance. But what the state of Alabama was doing at this time was they were paying for black students to go to schools out of state to keep you from going to our predominantly white schools within the state of Alabama. So Arthur Shores, a benefactor of that program, he gets into a correspondence course out of state, gets his JD, comes back to the state of Alabama, teaches himself the bar exam, takes the bar exam, ultimately passes it, becomes a lawyer. First black Birmingham councilman, and his daughter also ended up becoming judge, a circuit judge. Her name was Helen Shores Lee. So that's Arthur Shores. Within the black community, you had the black business community. And a lot of times these black business communities would service black individuals. So this is our replica of James Armstrong's barbershop. James Armstrong was known as the city barber. Whenever Martin Luther King Jr. came to the city of Birmingham and he got his hair cut, he sat in that very chair that we have right there, and he would get his hair cut by James Armstrong. James Armstrong was also an activist and part of the movement, and it was his two little boys that were integrating Graymont Elementary School, which was the catalyst that made KKK members want to put those sticks of dynamite out in front of 16th Street Baptist Church. Those were James Armstrong's children being escorted by Fred Shuttlesworth. And within the black community, you had not only barbershops and salons, that's where you would go You would get the, you know, the word of the day. You would get all the gossip and all those things in those spaces. But we also had other entities that we had to service ourselves. Case in point, funeral homes, okay? A.G. Gaston, the way he was first able to start his businesses here in Birmingham was with the Smith Gaston Funeral Home. And the way the Smith Gaston Funeral Home worked was, is that if you had a loved one you wanted to get buried, you only had to pay 75% of what that would cost. And then the Smith Gaston Funeral Home would pick up the other 25%. And so using that premise, A.G. Gaston was able to segue that business model into what ultimately became known as Booker T. Washington Insurance Company. And so with Booker T. Washington Insurance Company, you had life insurance, car insurance, all those other things that you underwrote. He also created what was known as Booker T. Washington Business School, because he understood that if we continue to live in a segregated environment, in a segregated city, that we're going to need more entrepreneurs to bring those services and those things across so that blacks can get the equal services as anyone else. But this is our section called Black Images in the White Mind. And this is where Madison Avenue is able to sell products at the expense of African-Americans. Case in point, Life Savers being depicted as a minstrel show, okay? Being portrayed in blackface. Even Aunt Jemima, the woman at this time who played Aunt Jemima, she had a master's degree in English. As a matter of fact, she was an English teacher right here locally at A.H. Parker High School. But she wanted to act. She wanted to get into the acting realm, but these were the only type of jobs that she could find during that time period. People always are wondering where the term Jim Crow came from. The term Jim Crow was actually the name of a song in a very, very popular minstrel show during the early 1900s, 1910s, and 20s. And the song was called Jim Crow. And it was so popular that, and it was a minstrel show where all the individuals were white people in blackface, and they're derogatorily portraying African-Americans. And so that's where the phrase Jim Crow came from. But right here we point out this film, Birth of a Nation. This film, Birth of a Nation, was shown in 1915. This was America's first blockbuster film. And it changed how cinematography was done going forward. It was also the first action flick. And it's still on the top, like, I think it's like 40-something in the top 100 movies of all time. Rumor, I usually don't speak my rumors, but rumor has it that President Warren G. Harding, was initiated into the KKK in the Oval Office. Case in point, we'll point out our little Klan robe right here. That Klan robe was donated to the Institute, I believe, in 1999. A local couple bought a house on the outskirts of town, was able finally to close on the property and get into the attic. When they got into the attic, they found a chest. In that chest, they had two robes and three hoods. And so they donated one. Cross in the background was a cross that was literally burning in an interracial couple's yard in Huntsville, Alabama. This is in 2001. Okay, so all this stuff not far removed. 2001. The couple comes outside, finds this cross burning on their front lawn, calls out the authorities. FBI ultimately comes out to do a thorough investigation. As they're investigating the area, knocking on doors and other people's houses, asking questions, they find this wood fence around this people's property. So they follow the wood fence around this people's property, and they find a gap in that wood fence. And so they take the wood from the cross, and they line it up to that wood fence, and they say, oh, we found out who did this. Two brothers locally decided to take the wood around their family home's fence to create this cross to burn in front of this interracial couple's yard. They were found out, ultimately convicted of a hate crime, and sentenced to federal penitentiary time. I'm not sure if they're still locked up or not. But Bombingham is one of Birmingham's other many nicknames. And Bombingham is a nickname that came because of over 50 unsolved bombings from the late 1940s to the 1960s. Out of all those bombings, the only time they had lost a life was with the four little girls and the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. This is Bethel Baptist Church. This is Fred Shuttlesworth Church, also the headquarters of the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. It was bombed three different times. Once on Christmas Day in 1956, and we're going to talk about that on the next timeline. A.D. King, Martin Luther King Jr.'s brother, was a pastor here in Birmingham. His house was bombed. Bombings were just a common thing, and that was because you're in Birmingham. This is a steel town. And dynamite was readily and easily available. One of the guys that ultimately was brought to justice with the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, his nickname was Dynamite Bob. Dynamite Bob drove around with 16 sticks of dynamite in his trunk all the time. Like, that was a cool thing to do. Like, that was not unstable and could erupt at any time. Case in point, you had the murder of Emmett Till in Money, Mississippi, 1955. Emmett Till's originally from Chicago. He's visiting family members in Mississippi, first time being there. Rumor has it that he catcalled a white woman. That woman has now on her deathbed said that that never occurred. That did not happen, right? She needs to be brought to justice for that. But what happened was is that her husband and an angry mob went to Emmett Till's cousin's house, and they knock on the door, and they tell Emmett Till's cousin, first time Emmett Till is meeting his cousin, okay? So this is, you know, this is family, but I don't really know you like that. But they tell them, they say, hey, you send that boy out right now, we're going to kill everybody in the house. Don't send the boy out, we'll kill everybody in the house. Send him out, we'll be amongst our way. What would you do? Like, I still try and wrap my brain around that to this day. So what Emmett Till's cousin was, he sent the boy out. And they took Emmett Till and they beat him. They beat him profusely. They beat him to a bloody pulp. They beat him so bad, and then decided they're going to shoot him in the head. Shoot him in the head. They take a chain. They wrap that chain around his neck, and they affixed that chain to an engine fan from a commercial engine. They take Emmett Till, the engine and the fan and everything, and they throw it all into the local river. Somehow, people think of maybe an act of God, that body surfaces. They find his body. They call Emmett Till's mother. She comes down from Chicago. They beg and they plead with her. Please just bury him here. Closed casket, small ceremony. You go back to Chicago, continue to live your life. She highly refused. She had the body shipped all the way back to Chicago. She had a funeral that was attended by thousands and thousands of individuals. She had an open casket, and a black magazine by the name of Jet Magazine showed the image of Emmett Till in that casket on the front page of their publication. And it sickened the world. And people understood then what individuals had to go through in regards to this movement. Two more things, and then we'll move on. Right here, you have December 26, 1956. But December 25, 1956, the night before, that's the remnants of Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth's house after it had been bombed. And he tells the story as, well, after he literally got blown into the ceiling, he came down into a crater where his bed used to be. He puts himself out because he's on fire, puts his house out, and gets all his family out of the house. Once he steps out, a police officer just runs up to him and says, Fred, I didn't think it would get this bad. If I was you, I would get my family and I would get out of town. And he told him, you are not me. And you can tell you and your KKK buddies that they cannot stop a man who is determined to see freedom. And so the very next day, Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth is on a bus here in Birmingham to test the laws that had now come down from the Montgomery bus boycott, saying that segregated or blacks having to sit in the back of the bus is unconstitutional. Now, I consider myself to be a pretty tough guy, but if you blow me up one day, I think I might at least need 7 or 8 days before I'm back out there. But not Fred Shuttlesworth. And this is what solidified him as being the leader here in Birmingham. Others envision this as being a miraculous thing, and that he was meant to be the leader of the civil rights movement of this town. And just to show how far Fred's influence went, I'm gonna point out right here, 1957, Mark 6. This individual, a reverend by the name of Lamar Weaver, local pastor, sympathetic to the civil rights movement. That's all he did. Shook Fred Shuttlesworth's hand while Fred and his wife were testing the segregation laws at the local train bus depot. Just shook his hand. From that one encounter, that one event, changed Reverend Lamar Weaver's life forever. From that moment on, he continuously got death threats. continuously, to the point where he sent his wife and his children out of state. And one day, they were having a civil rights meeting right here locally at Poole's Funeral Home. And so, through a clause that says that only men of the cloth, only clergy, can get past a certain point in a funeral home, they use that to their advantage. At this time, Reverend Lamar Weaver is getting followed by the KKK everywhere he goes. And so Fred and some other, they call him to Poole's Funeral Home for this meeting. Reverend Lamar Weaver pulls up, he gets out, goes into the fellowship hall at the funeral home. KKK's in tow. They're outside waiting. Lamar Weaver goes in, goes all the way to the back, where only clergy can go. He meets up with Fred and some other clergymen, and they tell him, we got something for you. So a full funeral is being had. At the end of that funeral, you have a procession with a hearse and all people in tow. Well, come to find out, Reverend Lamar Weaver did not know that he was going to his own funeral that day. And so they faked his death, put him in that hearse, in a casket, in the hearse, and snuck him out the city of Birmingham in a casket because of this one chance handshake with Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth. The Boycott Gallery, and this talks about Rosa Parks. Now, these individuals, Aurelia Browder, Johnny Carr, Claudette Colvin, Susie McDonald, are individuals who refused to give up their seats on Montgomery buses before Rosa Parks. So the question you should be asking yourself is, well, why don't we know who these individuals are? And the easiest way that I can answer that is basically by saying skeletons. There were issues that the NAACP saw with these individuals that let them know that they could not build their movement around this person. But they did have a young lady that's already a member of the NAACP locally, who was married, had a good job. Her job with the NAACP was to log sexual assault cases where white men were sexually assaulting black women, but those black women could not take those cases to the authorities. Nothing would happen. So Rosa Parks would log that these cases were taking place. She was so thorough with that position that she scheduled a boycott of a local grocery store where the owner of that grocery store sexually assaulted one of his black workers. They boycotted him until he left, closed his doors, and left town. That was the person that was beloved by that community in Montgomery. And so Rosa Parks was strategically chosen to not give up her seat. She was not tired that day. It was not a, I'm tired, I've been working all day, my feet hurt, I'm not getting up. It was strategy, and she was chosen. And before she could even make bail, they already had the flyers and things ready to start the Montgomery bus boycott. Because it was not the fact that they knew that they were going to do this boycott. That was the case. But the other fact was, now you're messing with Rosa, right? And everybody loved Rosa Parks. And so that's somebody that you can build your movement around. These other individuals, for whatever reason, the lady was too young and she cussed out the police officer when she was being arrested. One of them, they said, was too old. They didn't think that she would live throughout the trial, right? They think she would pass away mid-trial. Whatever the reasons were, Rosa was chosen to do what she did. So much so that they charged her with disorderly conduct. So the names that ultimately were on the case that changed the segregation laws in Montgomery was Aurelia Browder. Gail is the owner of the bus company. Was Aurelia Browder. Rosa Parks' name is not even on there because they did not charge her with not following the segregation laws on city buses. They charged her with disorderly conduct. 1960 is the foundation of what ultimately became the sit-in movement. Sit-in movement is when individuals go sit at lunch counters where they know they won't be served to show the inequalities of that decision. Now, one thing I do like to point out on the 1960 timeline is that this is a picture of Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth suing the Birmingham Airport Limousine Company for not serving him. But now, if you know, the name of the airport is the Shuttlesworth Birmingham airports. You know, back in the day when people say, I'm going to sue you, and I'm going to own this, and this is going to be mine. Well, this is Fred suing the airport. Now it has his name on it. One other side information about Fred Shuttlesworth is that he will probably go down in history as one individual to have the most litigation cases going on at one time. I believe that number is 45. He had 45 cases going on at the same time, all about changing the laws and the segregation laws in the South when it comes to Jim Crow. And he made sure that he was involved in just about every major civil rights case that came down during this era. This is our Freedom Ride exhibition. The Freedom Rides was a mixed campaign by an organization called CORE, Congress on Racial Equality. CORE had 7 blacks and 6 whites get on 2 buses starting in Washington, D.C. The ultimate goal was to make it to New Orleans and to test the inter-segregation laws. They get on the 2 buses, they're riding, they're cool. Once they get into the Deep South, the signs come up and the curtains come out. And now this mixed campaign where you have blacks and whites participating in the campaign, now they have to separate. Whites to the front, blacks to the back. They make it all the way to Atlanta. And the leader of CORE, James Lawson, finds out that his father passed away. So he has to get off this campaign, which is mostly just college students, him being the only adult. Now this group is left without a leader. So they petition Martin Luther King Jr. in Atlanta to join the Freedom Rides with them. King tells them no. And he tells them that he controls his own destiny. And he also is a little prophetic when he tells them that once you get into Alabama, you may be met with something that you're not ready for. And that was just the case. They make it into Anniston, Alabama, and they are first blocked off in the terminal by an angry mob, not able to leave the terminal. One bus driver, he sees this, he runs away. He's out, waiting on another driver. Other driver comes out, they're able to leave the area, but not too far outside of Anniston. They're literally ran off the road and a Molotov cocktail is thrown at the bus. As the individuals on the bus are trying to get off, as it starts to fill with smoke, the individuals that threw the Molotov cocktail holding the doors shut. As that Molotov cocktail starts to hit the fuel lines and starts to really erupt, the individuals holding the doors, they run for the hills. That allows everyone else on the bus to get off, including an undercover U.S. Marshal. His name is Hank Thomas. When I first started working here, he came and get a talk about his experience on that bus, and he said he thought for sure he was going to die that day. So much so that he laid in the middle aisle of the bus and just laid there. Because he figured, if I do get off the bus, my mama's going to kill me because I forged her signature on the permission slip to even participate in the campaign as a whole. So if this blast don't get me, my mama's going to get me, so I'm going to die. Ultimately, he did not die. He was able to get off the bus. The other bus, the Trailways bus, makes it into Birmingham. Once they make it to Birmingham, Bull Connor, the commissioner of public safety, calls his KKK buddies and he tells them, it's Mother's Day, mind you, he tells them, I will give y'all 15 minutes. 15 minutes is all you get. And so what happened was is that when the bus pulled into Birmingham, it was met by an angry mob, bats, chains, and those individuals were pulled off of that bus and they were beaten, and they were beaten profusely. So much so that many individuals could not continue. Some spend the night and stayed at Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth's house, whereas others, individuals came down from other places and other organizations like SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, people like John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis now, Diane Nash, James Lawson. Those individuals came down from Nashville, Fisk University, came to Birmingham to pick up where individuals who were beaten were not able to continue the march. They make it to Montgomery. Same thing happens. Angry mob surrounds the bus, so much so that the people ended up getting forced into a church where they are surrounded and held up. And that group is also beaten. This is where John Lewis says this is the first time he's ever had his head cracked open, was as a Freedom Rider in Montgomery. Robert F. Kennedy calls the governor of Mississippi, and he says, I know you know what happened in Alabama with these Freedom Riders. I'm not going to have any trouble out of you in Mississippi, am I? And he assures him, oh, no, you won't have any trouble out of us. As soon as they all get into Jackson, Mississippi, he arrests everyone, sends them to Parchman Penitentiary, sends them to hard labor. John Lewis said he spent 3 months at Parchment doing hard labor, but he arrested them all. Robert F. Kennedy has to ultimately send a plane to Jackson, has them all released, loaded on a plane, and flies them to New Orleans for a symbolic win. But this was not a successful civil rights campaign. This Jim Crow system utilized several different tactics to keep African Americans from being able to vote. A lot of times this affected poor whites as well. So the very first thing they instituted was what was called the Grandfather Clause. Grandfather Clause said that if your grandfather was a slave and could not vote, then you cannot vote, okay? That only lasts for so long. The further and further you get removed from slavery, the less and less the Grandfather Clause will work. The other thing they instituted was called poll taxes. A poll tax was an amount of money, usually $2, from every year that you first gained your right to vote until you exercise that right to vote, $2 per year. You know, so if you get the right to vote at 18, you exercise that right at 20, $4, not a big issue, right? But if you get that right to vote at 18 and you exercise your right for the first time at 80, that's a significant amount of money. Most people could not afford that at that time. That disenfranchised blacks as well as poor whites, all right? And the last thing they utilized was what was called a literacy test. A literacy test was like an 11th grade civic government exam where they ask you all these questions about the Constitution and stuff that we all should know that nobody remember, right? And so if you were an activist at this time, you would just train your people into whatever they needed to be able to register to vote. Or they would do basic things like physically, literally block the door so that no one could come in and register to vote. Now, if you were given the opportunity, you got the answer to your literacy test because y'all studied that. You got your $2, $4, $6, whatever you need for your poll tax. Now what? And this is where the ambiguous things started to come out, which no one had an answer for. Like, how many bubbles on a bar of soap? You got an answer for that? Or how many grains of sand at a beach? Or this is where the precursor to these fundraisers and stuff came from, where they would say stuff like, well, how many jelly beans in this jar? All of those things were things utilized to keep blacks from being able to register to vote. This is an expose called Who Speaks for Birmingham. We just got to listen to this dude really quickly, and then I'll move on.
They are the equals of the white man in every respect and should be just taken from savagery and put on the same plane with the white man in every respect. That's not true. He shouldn't be. It hurts the Negro. And that feeling has brought about this estrangement. And that feeling is brought about by outside sources, not by the Negroes residing in South Nigeria.
Well, Colonel, in view of the fact that possibly the federal government will ask the city of Birmingham at least to integrate their school system, what do you think will happen when that comes through?
I don't believe it'll ever happen. There would be a measure of violence in Birmingham, in my opinion, I regret to say. There's a lot of white people here that say this, that even the dumbest farmer in the world knows that if he has white chickens and black chickens, that the black chickens do better if they're kept in one yard to themselves, the white chickens do better if they're kept in a separate yard to themselves. They each do better under those conditions. And that a farmer who would mix the white and the black chickens would be the dumbest man in the world.
This is an expose called Who Speaks for Birmingham? And it was aired in 1961. And so in 1960, I believe it was, it might have been 61 as well, the New York Times wrote an article in their newspaper that said that Birmingham was the most vile, racist city in the country. And so the city leaders, some of the city leaders of Birmingham decided to sue the New York Times. So they sued them for $6 million. This isn't like 61 or whatever. So that's like an unheard amount of money. And so what CBS did was they said, well, okay, these folks are suing that New York Times, so let's go see. And so they came down here and they did this thing called Who Speaks for Birmingham. So they interviewed Fred Shuttlesworth. They interviewed some other city leaders. They went to Miles College, the HBCU, and interviewed students. They went to Birmingham Southern College, which is a white college at the time, and interviewed students as well. And so they were just trying to see if it's really as bad as everyone says it is. And so this showed throughout the whole country, but it was blacked out in the state of Alabama. These bars are the actual bars that King was behind when he wrote that famous letter from the Birmingham jail. So it's probably the one thing that we shouldn't allow anyone to touch, but we allow everybody to touch it. The money over there, people kind of use this like a wishing well, I hope that they take that money and use it for my raise. We'll see how that goes. These young people were actively engaged in this movement because they recognized that as young people living in the city of Birmingham, they did not want to have to continue to grow up in this segregated, racist city. So they wanted to make a change where they are. And so this is a picture of them going to jail in the city buses. And in that movement, by day one, you had over 900 children arrested. Day two was over 1,000. By day three, Bull Connor is thinking, how am I going to stop this madness? And so in his infinite wisdom, why or how he came up with this, I will never understand. But he decided that he was going to allow the Birmingham PD to utilize their police dogs to bite children and also to use the Birmingham Fire Department to spray the children with the water hoses. And this is some footage of that. And he told those firemen, he told them to up the pressure on those hoses. Those hoses had 100 pounds of pressure per square inch, enough pressure to literally rip the bark off the tree. And like I said before, one of the young ladies that was a participant in the movement sprayed in the head with the hose, literally ripped the hair out of her scalp, does not grow hair there today. That's like 50 years ago. So in the 8 days that this children's crusade lasted, you had over 7,000 children arrested. And not only did they feel the Birmingham City Jail, the Bessemer City Jail, and the Jefferson County Jail, that it was so many children that they had to use the school buses to take them to the fairgrounds where they had a petting zoo. And at that petting zoo in the fairgrounds, they utilized the petting zoo pen as a housing area for more students. Okay? And it was a rainstorm that happened during this movement as well. So now you're outside, you're with the animals, you're getting rained on, you're wet, you got parents coming down there throwing sandwiches and stuff over the fence so that the children can have something to eat. But they were willing to go through all of that to see change in their city.
Pretty impressive, huh?
Yes, very. And like I told you all before, Shuttlesworth was sprayed with a hose on 16th Street, where he came down and literally broke several ribs and was in the hospital, where ultimately individuals were able to sit with the business leaders to negotiate the desegregation of downtown Birmingham. And so that's Fred looking a little disheveled there a little bit, making it to that meeting so that he can negotiate on behalf of his city with these leaders. Only thing I'm going to say about the March on Washington for Freedom and Jobs is that Shuttlesworth was a contributor to that march as well. He spoke. Nobody talks about it. John Lewis spoke. He had the most fiery speech of them all because he was very critical of the Kennedy administration. And they asked him to change his speech right before he gave it, and he did. He dialed it down a little bit because they didn't want to be too critical of Kennedy, knowing that we need him to sign that Civil Rights Act and that Voting Rights Act. And then the other thing I would say is that King was not meant to give the I Have a Dream speech that day. He had given that speech about 2 weeks prior at 16th Street Baptist Church. And when Mahalia Jackson, his favorite gospel singer, who had sung right before he came up, she was going to sit down as King is coming up to speak. Mahalia Jackson says, King, tell him about your dream. Tell him about your dream, King. And so Martin Luther King Jr. takes the speech that he has, puts it to the side, and rolls the I Have a Dream speech off the top of his head. And that is how we know about the I Have a Dream speech. So what I always ask myself is, what's that other speech? Where is it? And what would have been the three-word soundbite that we would have shrouded King in based off of that speech? 16th Street Baptist Church, this is Floyd and Dwight Armstrong, the Barber children, Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth integrating Graymont Elementary School. This is about a week before what happens at the church. In protest of this event is why they put 19 sticks of dynamite out in front of this church. And on 10:22 a.m., September 15th, that blast goes off. And five little girls are blown up. Four of them lose their lives. One lost her little sister and the vision in her right eye. And then also, we talked about it before, with the six spirits, two young men killed also on that same day. Virgil Lamar Ware is in the Sandusky part of town. He's riding on the handlebars of his brother's bike. Two Eagle Scouts coming from a KKK rally where they're bragging about what happened at 16th Street that day have a weapon And they decided they're going to scare these two black children by brandishing their weapon. But if you're like me, you come from a neighborhood where that kind of stuff, you just showing me a gun don't scare me, right? They decided to shoot in their direction. That shot hits Virgil Lamar Ware in his chest, killing him. The two Eagle Scouts are arrested because they admit to what they did. And as they go to trial, the judge says that he doesn't want to ruin their lives over something so insignificant, considering that they're A students and Eagle Scouts, so he lets them go, 6 months juvenile detention time served. Same day, Johnny Robinson lives in this neighborhood right up here before all these buildings and stuff, right? And he knows what happened at 16th Street. And this was a major thoroughfare from the city area to the white parts of town, over the mountain, Mountain Brook, and these other places. And so they're throwing rocks at cars as they go by. Someone calls the authorities. When the police come out, the crowd of children run. The attending officer pulls his revolver, shoots it into the crowd, hitting Johnny Robinson in his back, killing him. At first, they try to sweep it under the rug, but as the crowd is building, you already have what happened at 16th Street happened earlier in the day. People are upset, so he calls it a justified shooting. He disperses all his officers back to the precinct, tries to defuse the crowd, and they get a hold of Johnny Robinson's parents, and they tell them to come get their child up off the ground. Right here, we have some personal effects of Miss Denise McNair. She was the youngest of the four little girls who died that day. Her father was a local photographer and also ultimately became a city councilman. These are her shoes and her little Bible, bracelet, necklace, and also the piece of concrete that they found lodged in her head. My boss, who hired me, put this case together, has two little girls of his own. He said he was fine putting out the purse, even the piece of concrete. Everything was fine until those shoes. When he saw those shoes and compared that to his own children, he had to walk away and take a moment. It became overwhelming at that point, thinking about the possibility of losing your child through an act of violence like this. Last thing I'll point out is our 1965 timeline and about the Selma to Montgomery March. Selma to Montgomery March happened in 1965. And prior to the march, there was an individual by the name of James Orange. He was a Birmingham activist who was assisting with the voting registrations going on in Selma. He was empowering young people to become part of the movement, like what happened here in Birmingham. And so with that youth movement, the youth were able to mobilize, but they tried to get their teachers involved as well. And the teachers were not able to mobilize. So James Orange comes down from Birmingham to assist in that. While he's assisting in that, he gets arrested. And when he gets arrested, the sheriff down there, the chief of police, calls the KKK and he tells him that he has a present for him, talking about Mr. Orange. The word gets around and members of Brown Chapel Church and other activists, black activists in the area, decided they're going to create a human chain around that jail so that they cannot get to James Orange. Ultimately, deputized individuals come and there is an attack on those individuals surrounding the jail. And Jimmy Lee Jackson, a young man who served his country in World War II, sees one of these deputized individuals, some say it was his mom, but he was beating one of his family members. Jimmy Lee Jackson goes to get that person off of his family member. That person pulls their revolver, shoots Jimmy Jackson, killing him. That catalyzed the Selma to Montgomery March. What they wanted to do was take Jimmy Lee Jackson's body and throw it on the steps of the State House in Montgomery. And so that this is what's going on. Martin Luther King Jr. gets involved, and he diffuses that idea. And James Bevel, a preacher out of Mississippi who organized the children in the Children's Crusade, he decides that we're going to march from Selma to Montgomery. It's about 54 miles. And this is where the idea of the Selma to Montgomery March comes. They attempt to march Bloody Sunday, where they are beaten by deputized sheriff officers over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So they try it again, turn around Tuesday, 2 days later, Martin Luther King Jr. is now involved. He leads them up to the Edmund Pettus Bridge. They kneel, they pray, They turn around, they go back to Brown Chapel because they're waiting on an injunction from Frank Johnson. Frank Johnson was a white judge that King called the Hand of Justice. And Frank Johnson was ultimately able to file that injunction to give them protection for the duration of that march. And they were ultimately able to make it to Montgomery, where King gave his famous speech, "How long, not long," okay? But he had to give that speech in the flatbed back of a truck because they would not let Martin Luther King Jr. stand on the state capitol steps because that's where Jefferson Davis was inaugurated as the president of the Confederacy. So because Jefferson Davis was inaugurated on the steps of the Capitol as the president of the Confederacy, they denied Martin Luther King Jr. the ability to stand on those steps and give his famous "How long, not long" speech. I just found that out recently, so I had to say that. I thought that was crazy.
Yeah.
What? Just because of Jefferson Davis. But this is normally where I end my tours. We do have the Office of the Mayor where they talk about in other parts of the world, they utilize the things that happened here in Birmingham in 63 with the Children's Crusade to fight for whatever issues they're fighting for in their respective countries.
Wow. A lot to digest.
It is a lot. It is a lot. It's a lot to remember, too.
If somebody wanted to learn more, where would you direct them?
I would direct them to our website. That's www.bcri.org. We have a section on there called Education, where they can get lesson plans dealing with the civil rights movement, as well as additional information. My name is Charles Woods III. I'm the Education Programs Manager, as well as the Community Outreach Coordinator here at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute.
Charles, thanks so much for the day. This has been touching.
No problem.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
The Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative was recently awarded the prestigious Phoenix Award by the Society of American Travel Writers. HLRI was one of four recipients of the prestigious award that recognizes international organizations actively involved in conservation, preservation, beautification, and anti-pollution campaigns that further the growth and appeal of travel destinations.